Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. With me again today on this episode is Juliana, my girlfriend. Say hello, everyone.
Hello, everyone.
And we're going to be talking about a book. First of all, two bits of follow-up, which are very important. Well, not very important, but I forgot to, one of them I forgot to mention on the last podcast because we reviewed The Martian not long ago, and it's about, you know, NASA saving people's skin and on Mars, and they're going to send a rocket here and there and stuff like that. You should listen to our review or actually just read the book because it's really good. What I wanted to bring attention to last time and forgot is this great, fantastic article on Ars Technica, the Ars Technica website. And it's the audacious rescue plan that might have saved Space Shuttle Columbia. And it's that NASA produced a report after the Columbia disaster in 2003, and about, like, would it have been possible to save the crew? Would it have been possible to send up another shuttle and get the shuttle ready in time to send it up and to transfer the people from one shuttle to the other shuttle and then to bring everyone back down, the two crews back down in one shuttle? And it turns out, maybe. But instead of reading the really, really long report, this big appendix to this long report about how it was done, this reporter from Lee Hutchinson wrote it all up, and it's a really fantastic article, and it's like the real life, what if, it's the real life Martian. People are stranded in space, what can NASA do to get them back down from space? And it's really amazing, and I recommend people read it. So just search for Ars Technica, Space Shuttle Columbia, or Rescue Plan Shuttle Columbia, you'll be able to get it. Even though there is actually a mistake here, it says Saved Space Shuttle Columbia, whereas the shuttle is the entire thing. It should actually be Orbiter Columbia, because the thing that everyone calls the shuttle is actually the shuttle orbiter, and the shuttle is actually the whole unit of everything together. All of the rockets and tanks attached. That is the shuttle.
Oh, okay.
And the shuttle orbiter is what we think of as the shuttle. So
it looks like a shuttle.
What do you mean it looks like a shuttle? No, a shuttle is something to move one thing from one point to the other point.
Yeah.
So this is a shuttle, but I'm saying this is the shuttle orbiter, not the whole shuttle.
Okay.
It's just a small technical thing that I thought
it's a rocket and a shuttle attached.
No, it's the shuttle with an orbiter attached.
Okay.
So
good to know.
There you go. That's a little thing there. What was the other bit of feedback? Oh yes, I got this very good email, and this is the very important email from Alan Smith. He says the state of the art review. This will only make sense if you listen to our last review of the state of the art. It says, hi Luke, I've just caught up with your state of the art review by yourself and Juliana, and as usual found it really enjoyable and entertaining, blah blah blah. However, apart from the literary aspect of the discussion, I also found your mini argument about masturbation utterly hilarious. I don't always side with you against Juliana, but I have to say in this case I think you climbed down far too easily. Your explanation was not just psychologically true as you stated, but also totally biological accurate. Essentially, as we all know, women are born with a finite number of eggs, whereas we guys, well, the factory keeps on producing, and as you say, the output just has to go somewhere. The email goes on for another paragraph, but that's very important that it's not just me who says that men have to get rid of the sperm by masturbation. And that's why it's mentioned in some and isn't mentioned in others. You know, it was mentioned in Ian M. Banks's story about someone walking across Mars, well, not Mars, walking across a planet in a spacesuit,
which I always had in mind was.
But it wasn't mentioned in. It wasn't mentioned in Have Spacesuit Will Travel or in The Martian. Have Spacesuit Will Travel is a book for kids anyway, so it probably wouldn't have been mentioned there. Anyway, there's some two little bits of not feedback, but little updates. So now let's get on to today's episode. We're going to be talking about Flowers for Algernon, which is written by Daniel Keyes, which I have reviewed previously here on the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast back in, episode 116 episodes. So that's like, and what is it now? We're all the way up to episode 222. So about half the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast ago, I read this book and gave it 5 stars. And I can't remember if in that review, because I didn't listen back to it, but I can't remember if in that review I mentioned, if it was a spoiler or anything, but this is a discussion between two people, so it's going to be lots of spoilers. So if you don't want this book to be spoiled, Go and read it because it's a very good book. You think it's a good book?
Yes.
It's highly recommended by both of us, and just it's a, you know, it's a classic book. It won the Nebula Award for Best Novel. It was nominated for the Hugo Award. Not that these awards mean very much, but it is a classic book. On the front cover, it has 5 million copies sold. So even if you don't like this book, it's worth reading just as a historically important science fiction novel and a very influential science fiction novel. And many people's favourite science fiction novel of all time. So read it and then come back and listen to the rest of this discussion or check out my previous discussion. But hopefully we'll say new stuff, which I didn't say last time out, especially because I've got more stuff to say about it. And of course, Juliana has obviously got stuff to say about it. So do you want to start off? Do you want to give a quick outline of the story? Because you've got the Wikipedia page in front of you and your notes in front of you.
I should have read the Wikipedia page about it beforehand because it actually seems to be quite interesting.
Yeah.
So Daniel Keyes wrote it in 1958.
Yes. First of all, it was a short story.
First of all, it was a short story, but then he obviously
expanded it out.
And I read the big book.
You read the German translation of the full novel. I read the English version of the full novel, ebook version.
Yes.
Which is quite weird because sometimes there's a few formatting mistakes in the novel. And at some points I was thinking, is this a formatting mistake in the novel or is it just the bad writing? Because the structure of the novel is that someone, Charlie Gordon, is making progress reports and he is a, in the book he's called a mentally retarded, obviously mentally disabled. I'm not sure what the technical term is, but the language in the book is, because it was written in the 1950s, he's classed as a retard, and people talk about him as a retard quite openly. You know, the scientists call him a retard, everyone else calls him a retard.
He himself knows that he goes to a school for retarded adults.
The school is called a school for retarded adults, which, so now, while that's like not really politically correct, it is the language in the book, so it's difficult to talk around the language in the book when the book is so open and is about that. You know, it's to say this guy is a retard, although I feel uncomfortable using that word.
Yeah,
myself.
I mean, let's state that he has an IQ of 68.
Yeah.
So I think the average is about 100.
That is the definition of average intelligence is IQ 100.
Okay.
And that is the measuring point.
I'm slightly above.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've never done a test which has convinced me that I'm...
Yeah.
That it's
so
a real test.
It is so difficult to test the IQ. But to make sure... I mean, Charlie is a very naive and... he can't deep in things so deeply.
Like, yeah, can't think things deeply. Yeah.
And so that's mainly maybe that what comes out when you see his behavior.
Yeah.
How he's describing it. He's always describing from his point of view.
Yeah, it's very unreliable narrator.
But by him telling, but I mean by us reading what he's telling, we understand what is going on.
Yeah.
And he doesn't.
Yeah. So just to be clear about this, there's what I was saying before about the formatting problems. It starts off, it's because it's all written from his point of view as like journal entries or progress reports. He writes very badly with bad grammar and bad punctuation and bad spelling and very simple words. And then he has an operation to make him more intelligent, and his intelligence increases until about 2/3 of the way through the book. And then, and as that goes along, his language and his writing is gets much better. First of all, he writes with a pencil, then he writes with a typewriter, and finally he dictates into a dictaphone, into a recorder, which is then the notes are written up. And then it goes back again. He loses his intelligence, and then the writing and the English language and grammar
decreases
and everything
again.
Not quite to how bad it was at the beginning of the book, but it does go back in that direction.
Yeah.
By the time he stops writing his journal,
so he has actually he has a something that is called phenylketonuria.
Yeah.
It's actually
a genetic disorder.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not only he's retarded.
Yeah, well, that is his retardation.
And also, why he gets the operation? He doesn't only get an operation. He also gets some of these. How do you call them? Enzymes.
Enzymes. Yeah.
That's what later on in the book, when he actually understands what's going on and he does research himself, he then figures out what is going on
and what mistakes were made. Yeah,
mistakes were made, because then in the book, in the middle of the book, he actually is more intelligent than all the people who were his doctors and who treated him at the beginning.
Yeah.
So he goes from lower than pretty much anybody else to higher than everybody else.
Yeah.
And then
back again.
And then back again.
But what I want to say about this, the writing is, it's not just about, oh, this is clever, there's different word choice, there's different sentence structure, there's different that, there's different this. The idea of it being an unreliable narrator, as you were saying before, like, we see things from his point of view. I was wondering, is there a point in his intelligence where he is no longer an unreliable narrator and becomes a reliable narrator? Because when he's very stupid, he isn't interacting with people on the same level and things are happening and he just doesn't understand them.
Yes.
And then when he's super intelligent, he's the other end of that. He's so above other people that stuff is happening, but because he's so self-absorbed and just can't interact with people anymore, like he can't identify them with on a human level and is misunderstanding them because he still thinks that they're playing, that they're stupid. They're saying these guys were pretending to be really intelligent and they're not. So we're seeing it from like the elevated or beyond point of view, which is still an untrustworthy narrator.
Yeah.
And then back down to the other way, where we're back to untrustworthy. And I was thinking, is there a...
must be some part where it is like on the normal level.
On the normal level. When he gets to IQ 100 and he's interacting with people, does his language and intelligence and everything match up? And at that point, does he have a reliable narration? Like, is he reliable?
There's actually one point like going on with this his teacher at the beginning, and he the more intelligent he becomes, the more he realizes that he has feelings for her.
Yeah.
And there's one point right at the end of the book, just before all the backwards stuff starts, where he is on the same level with her,
and back again
he actually says that, and she says that too, we are now on the same level. And this is the point where he actually can hold up a relationship with her, where he can actually then accept her as she is. And also, very important, because this book is all about Freud and psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
This is then the point where he actually is kind of
imbalanced,
because then he can have sex without Charlie.
Yeah, exactly. This was going to be my point. On the way up, there is no meeting because his emotional development is well behind his intelligence development. But on the way down, he reaches the point where everything comes into line. His emotional intelligence lines up with his intellectual intelligence.
Yes, so there is one point.
And his natural age and the state of his relationships with other people.
Yes.
And all of those kind of things. It all meets again, but it doesn't happen on the way up. It only happens on the way down on the other side.
Exactly. And also, I think the way down is the more touching part, is the part where it kind of goes in a good way. Because like even when he's down again, it is better than it was before.
What do you mean? Like at the end of the book? No, I just think they cut off at the end of the book. He's still kind of self-aware at the end of the book that he's still got some memories and still things that are going on. He understands his situation, but I reckon give it another month and he'd be exactly back to where he was. This would just be a part of his life which he doesn't remember in the same way that he doesn't remember his childhood. He doesn't remember this. He just lets everything go. And this hyper-intelligent part of his life will just be one of those experiences, like losing his father, like losing his, you know, like all the interactions that he had with his family when he was a child.
Yeah,
it will just be one thing in his past and he wouldn't remember it, but now he'll be living over in the Warren State Home.
Yeah, so one thing I just read on Goodreads, that obviously this is a book that many people read in school. They read the short story in school.
Yeah,
and
or the novel in school, I think.
I don't know. And this is a book I've never come across before.
No.
But obviously this is something in English schools.
I didn't know it was an English school book.
Okay.
I mean, it is good that, I mean, a lot of these books you do read in school, which are kind of like science fiction books, but kind of like low-level science fiction. So they're not about starships and laser guns and stuff. It's more about like the social side. You know, a bit like 1984. That would be a book that you could do in school, or you know, Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah. But then I always think, like, the books I read in school were all books that I, like, we read Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
And I just didn't really read through it. And well, like that, because you have to read it. And
I know.
You have to
analyze
it. And then you have to find something in it. And I think, well, this is obviously a book that shows a lot of points. But then I think it only, you really get these points once you're a grown-up person. And like,
which book? In
Flowers of Argument.
Yeah, I mean, it's about somebody becoming a 30-year-old adult.
Exactly.
A hyper-intelligent 30-year-old adult.
How can people, like, how can students in school, which are probably about, like, maybe 16 or 17 or whatever.
No, probably younger, probably maybe 14 you'll be reading this book, or 15
really?
Or something. Yeah, I don't know.
How do they understand this? I mean, they don't understand what it means to go... be in university to write intelligent things.
Yeah, I know. I totally agree with you. The schools often pick weird books or books which you just go, well, why? What I always hated about books in school is that we'd get given a book and it would take people like 6 weeks to read through a novel, and I'd finished it by the second day or the third day. I'd just finished the book like I would do. And then it would just be sitting and there would just be literally people be reading it in, like they'd sit down and be reading like a whole chapter in class, like taking turns to read it out and then talking about it and then this and then that. And it was just so tedious. It kind of destroyed, because I'd read the book, had all my opinions formed about the book, and then in the classes themselves didn't get anything more out of the books and was just reading other books, you know. I'm not saying that I'm more intelligent. It's just that, you know, I obviously like reading a lot more than
the
average person in school. Yeah. So I didn't mind the books when I first read the books. Like, you know, I also read... I can't remember the books that I read in school, because there were lots of school books which were there not just for our class, but there was sort of like, they would have like 30 copies of 1984, and then there was 30 copies of a book called Z for Zachariah, which is like a post-apocalypse book.
Sounds like World War Z.
That kind of thing. No zombies though, but it's after a nuclear holocaust, and there's like only a few people left surviving and things. And there was all these other books. The Wave was one, which was like a neo-Nazi kind of thing. Did you read the Wave?
No, but it's well known in Germany. Yeah.
And those books, but I can't remember which ones I studied in my classes, because they were always there, and I would just pick them up and read them. You know, I would just read all the books for all of the classes that were taken, even if our specific class didn't take that book. Anyway, so what else did you want to say about this book?
So there's loads of stuff to talk about.
No, I meant on that point about reading in school. You just think it's a bad book to read in school.
No, I don't think it's a bad book, but it's very delicate, because it has so many points that you need to understand. So you can't talk in class about psychoanalysis, and you can't talk about what is a Rorschach test.
Yeah.
And there's so many things that you need to cut off from this book. To talk it through with children
or young people,
that is so much get lost on that one. So it's really difficult. I think there are better books in school to read.
Yeah, I think
and
so.
To learn,
but it's
stuff.
So difficult. Like, what books should you read? I mean, now these days, I think it's great that you do have like the young adult fiction, which is written for the age group.
Exactly.
So nothing is. I mean, I wouldn't say nothing is too technical, but it's, you know, it's pitched. The protagonist will probably be young people rather than 30-year-old mentally disabled people trying to have adult relationships with the teacher.
Also,
it's just weird.
And also, you will have the same problems that in maybe in other books you get in adult books.
Yeah.
But on the level of young adults, young people will understand these problems, the problems of relationship, problems of responsibility, problems of like all kinds of that they also meet in their lives, which is also important. You only can understand something if you actually kind of experienced it or know about it.
Yeah. So are you saying you don't know about... I mean, there's lots of adult things, but have you had any experience with mentally disabled people? I mean, is that a topic that has... does it touch close to your...
To me?
To you, yeah.
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so? Well, for me, there's two stories I can mention about like this, which one is that, of course, my grandparents. When I was growing up, my grandmother was always, you know, rosy and happy and doing good stuff and things like that. And my grandfather, Richard, we would always call him, his nickname was Grampy, you know, like you call him, you know, there's different names that you call your grandparents. It was Granny and Grampy, but we would always call him Grumpy because he would be like, he'd really hardworking guy. He worked on a dairy farm, would get up at 4 o'clock every morning to milk the cows and again in the afternoon, do it again in the afternoon and all this, and he would be grumpy. And then my grandfather had a stroke and suddenly became like, this is, they're both like 90 something now or something like that, in the 90s. And so he had a stroke and was suddenly, it changed his personality. And now he's like, you know, going out and making friends and doing stuff. And
watching football.
Yeah, well he always used to watch sport, but you know, he was always getting into things. Then his son bought him a computer and he was going to use the internet. And then of course that didn't work because he's just too old and stuff like that. Maybe if someone gave him an iPad, he would, you know, read stuff and play games and things like that. That's the kind of thing that you need now. But at the same, around about the same time, or just before, well, it was probably all connected, my grandmother had a like a breakdown, and she now sits in a home, and visiting her is super depressing because she just sits on a chair all day, every day, staring forward. You know, there's books around her, TV's turned off, books are closed, magazines are closed. She literally just sits down and stares. And when you visit her, you just sit in a room and either talk to her and she just ignores you. And anyway, it was such a weird thing that my grandparents kind of like had a, one color of a switch in personality, but their brains changed. You know, you have a stroke, your brain changed. And it was so weird that my grandfather had, you know, a stroke and it kind of changed him for the, not for the, I don't want to say for the better, but there was obviously something happened which changed him. Maybe he was like, oh, I had a stroke. Maybe he consciously changed or he unconsciously changed. But it's such a weird situation to see people's personalities change, even at such an old age where normally things happen. Normally the way is along with my grandmother, it's like a deterioration and it restricts her quality of life, or it would restrict someone's quality of life. But then with my grandfather, it kind of, his quality of life kind of blossomed and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just not having to live with my grandmother anymore, or what, you know, it's just a change in situation, obviously, like, freed him up to live his own life independently in a way that hasn't been there. And I'm not quite sure what that says about this, but but I guess that's kind of happened since I last read this book, and it does make me look at that in a different way, you know. I'm not,
see something deeper. Yeah,
I see something deeper there, just to go, well, what would it have been like if my grandfather had been keeping progress reports through that time?
Yeah.
What and most people like don't. Read them? Most people don't know that they're going to have a stroke. And I do think this kind of things being documented in that way is fascinating. And, you know, I almost wish more people would do it. You know, it goes back to that kind of the Total Recall idea of not the movie, but the idea being that if you keep track of everything, if you keep a journal, if you do all that kind of stuff,
you can see your progress.
You can see your progress.
Yeah.
Like I kept a diary, like a journal for a whole year, and it was, and I've not gone back and read through it, but it would be really weird because that was the year that, you know, I was having fun as a single, and then me and Juliana met and got together. And I'm sure that the word choice that I'm using and the way that I'm writing the journal will be completely different from the beginning of that year, from one birthday, one August 26th, through to the next August 26th, I would have a different outlook, a different, you know, and it's such a mild thing, but brain states do change. And,
yes, I know. And I always wished I would have been able to do diary writing. And
you never did?
I never did. I was never able. I always tried again and again, and somebody else gave me a diary, like, you, for birthday in here.
Yeah.
And I always started, and like after some days, I just can't. I'm not a writing kind of person. I don't. I'm not comfortable writing down something, and which is always a pity because I think I always feel, but I think that's most people feel like that they don't change. And but by having these reports or diary entries, you know that you can see how much you changed. And you're distracted now.
So I was just opening up. It's a thing called All Diary.
Oh wow! Just a big text document.
It's a massive text document with 211,106 words.
and even more characters.
Well, of course, even more characters. But that was in 1 year. I wrote over 200,000 words.
Yes.
About my own life, which that's what the reason I didn't continue is just because it takes a long time.
Yeah, of course.
That's a lot of words to write.
Yeah.
But just imagine if everyone kept that much data about their daily thought processes.
Of course.
As everyone else.
You would have so much data about humans.
Yeah. And that's why you can't just present that to somebody. That's why not even I am going to read that, because 200,000 words is like a decent chunky-sized novel.
Yeah.
And you really need it to be edited down to the highlights.
Yes.
You know, if Daniel Keyes went through my diary and edited it down like he did with Charlie Gordon's journal progress reports,
yeah,
like, would I be able to find a story in there? And of course, yes, I would, because it was the time that we got together, and so the story could be a love story, or it could be this, it could be work trips and other things that I did. There was actually two relationships there, because a previous relationship only lasted a few months, so there's the beginning of that and the end of that.
Yeah.
And all of the stuff.
And then the beginning of ours.
And then, other stuff going on. And
so, coming back to the book, I think we did quite a...
Yeah, I'm just saying, but like, I just find it interesting, mindsets via journaling over the course of brains changing.
And also, like, during the book, he several times is writing, oh, I can't keep up with these reports.
Well, that's a convention in when you're doing a journal, like a novel, like a storytelling via a journal, is that you, like, when nothing interesting has happened, you just go, oh, I've not had a chance to fill in this journal for the last few days. Let me just do a quick recap of what's happened.
Yes.
And it's a way of passing time quickly instead of every day. Like
every
you would have to.
I brushed my teeth, I had breakfast, and, like, this would just repeat over and over again.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to say about flowers for, I don't know, how, shall we get into the book again?
Yes, definitely, yeah.
What is the meaning and the relationship, and the meaning of the relationship between the mouse and Charlie?
Well, they had the same operation going on, and what Charlie saw happening to Algernon, the mouse, he knew that would happen to him.
Yeah.
Not that he was going to die in the end, because that just happens to people who can't look after things.
Mouse don't live so long.
Yeah, they just die anyway, yeah. So, and he worked out the correlation between the mouse's progress and his progress. And he's saying, oh, and the mouse would throw itself against the wall of the maze and become angry, you know, and fight people and bite people. And you kind of see that happening to him.
Yes, of course.
Of course, it's written from his point of view, so he doesn't realize that he's becoming unlikable and angry and irritable.
Yeah.
I mean, he does at the end, but...
What I was thinking about, like, because this whole book is pretty much going through psychoanalysis. If you read that book, you will have quite a good view about what Freud was talking about.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, the steps that are shown in that book. You have Charlie as an easy person. As a simple-minded.
There's no
person.
Complex. He has
no
ego or super ego. He's
so
just the id.
It is id.
Id.
And then comes the ego, which is the progress. And then in the top is his super ego, where he is, like, super, super conscious of what he does. He's, like, very...
Well, he's
like,
even told by Strauss? He actually says, don't read up on psychoanalysis or
anything.
Exactly. Because then you will understand, you will have, you know...
You will understand all the meaning behind it.
Yeah.
And also, I was thinking of that... these three things. You have the very intelligent, you have the super ego Charlie, where he's like he's above all the others. This is the super ego. And then the simple Charlie is the ego. And then the id is the mouse.
Ah, you think the id is that represents his core, his
exactly, yeah. So you have so many different levels in that book. And also, like, one good point in that was when he does these several, like, Rorschach tests at the beginning.
In English, it's
how do you pronounce
it? It's spelled the Rorschach test.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he says, I had to do the Rorschach test. And
yeah,
when I first read it, I was like, Rorschach test.
Yeah,
yeah.
So it's a German, it's a, oh, no, what it was, Austrian. Where is it? It's Swiss. It was a Swiss psychologist. Hermann Rorschach, and this is the spelling. You pronounce it Rorschach,
yeah.
And this is Rorschach test, the ink dot, or how you
ink
call
blot.
It, ink blot.
Yeah.
And so at the beginning, Charlie is just seeing, he's saying, oh, it's just ink blots.
No, I love it. It's sort of like, this is one of my favorite parts of the beginning of the book, where they're saying, look, what's the picture here?
What's the picture behind it?
Yeah, he says, what's the picture in the ink box? And then he's saying, the picture is someone has spilt ink on the bit of paper.
Yeah.
And they say, no, but what's the picture? The picture is of spilt ink. And I really love that it's like purely surface. Like yeah, there's something,
nothing behind it.
Yeah.
And then later on, when he's then intelligent enough and he read all the psychology books and all this.
He knows what people want to hear.
He has this knowledge. And then the psychologist, who is it, Strauss?
I think it's Strauss.
He's asking, what picture do you see? No, it was Bird. Yeah, and he was...
No, Bert did the physical test, like the maze test, and Strauss did the psychological tests.
Okay, anyway, I thought it was Bert, and where he was asking, what picture do you see behind this thing?
Strauss was the psychologist, and Bert was the technician, the lab technician, who was earning his PhD, and Nemo was the guy who had the... who actually designed the initial... procedure.
Yeah,
and
he's more like a...
Nemo was in charge. Strauss was doing then, psychoanalysis.
Anyway, so, but at the... when he was more intelligent than the other people, that he again had problems with this test.
Yeah.
Because he was thinking about what the other person want him to say.
Yeah.
More about this way... if he says this now,
they will think
it will imply this.
Yeah.
If he says this now, and it will imply another thing, and because he knows what things imply, he can't decide. He can't say it. He can't see just a simple picture in it.
No.
So there's no point by doing these Rorschach tests where he actually just looks at it and sees, oh, this is. Whatever, two koalas hanging on a tree. This is what I see there.
What, and that one?
Yeah.
Now you've said two koalas hanging on a tree.
You see them too.
I can only see them.
Exactly.
And I can't see anything else.
Exactly.
So if you show me another one, I could say that. But
exactly. Well, we are just like normal behaving people.
And we see koalas in trees.
I just see koalas in trees. Other people might see whatever.
Like looking at it again, you can see it's like a weird bat looking, or a fox or something looking directly at it.
It
yeah.
obviously has some ears there.
In case you're wondering, we're looking at the Wikipedia page for Rorschach test.
Yeah, and there you can see koalas hanging on a tree. Anyway, but what I'm trying to say here is that he has problems.
Of course he has problems.
All the time.
Yes.
There's no time.
There's no time where
he's no problems.
Yeah,
this poor guy.
And even on the way down again, when he's like, he's doing okay in the test, but then he starts failing and he can't remember what the maze was and stuff. He's just like, okay, no more tests. I just can't do this anymore. Yeah,
because he knows that he once did know about it. So
another thing that another note that I made is like, he has these flashbacks to when he was learning stuff, and at one point he learned how to use the bread mixing machine, and it worked, you know.
Yeah.
But then later on, he has a flashback to before he had the operation where they said, "Oh, here is how you make a bread roll.
Yeah,
you cut off this bit of thing, you roll it up, you do this, and then you put it there. Now you try." And he did it perfectly once, and then they were like, "You know," when he was doing it along with them, and he saw
it was good.
But he was being, what I really liked about it is that he didn't have. He couldn't, like, everything was coming in, but he couldn't discard information. And this is one of those autism things. It's like, it's not that they don't understand, or that they can't see what's going on, or don't understand what's going on. It's just that there's so much coming in that they can't strip out human, like non-specific human movement by somebody else. Like, when you hug someone, it's too close. They're getting overwhelmed, like, with autism. They'll get overwhelmed by the smell and the action and the warmth, you know. There's just too many senses and they can't block them out and just go, ah, comfort, you know. And that's one of those weird things where, you know, the parents think their kids don't love them because they don't respond to hugs and kisses and human closeness, and they want to be that's not quite with Charlie, but he explains, like, oh, he's holding his hand exactly like this, and instead of interpreting pick this thing up, he's there going, extend your hand out to this level and do this with your fingers and then close your fingers around this thing and then pick it up. So it's all happening on like kind of machine level instead of like on the higher level of just going, pick this up and move it over there. It's like, move your body to this position, lift your arm to this position.
And then, because it is so complex in this kind of, like, in this specific moment, he can't recall, then when he's supposed to do it alone, he can't recall the steps, when was which step.
Yeah, and I think, but what I'm saying is this kind of generalizes out to his whole life, I think, you know. It's only later when he starts understanding, I was once a child and I had someone called a sister and a mother and this was their basic relationship to me. It's only when he understands that he had an abusive relationship with his mother, even when his mother wanted the best for him before his sister was born, he didn't understand the overall nature of that. And he didn't have a framework to fit in the individual actions and attitudes and memories.
Of course.
So it all just passed away. In the same way that instead of just going, pick up this bit of bread and move it over there, if he had that framework, then he would have been able to understand the individual steps or even be able to remember the individual steps because he could work it out as he goes along. So I'm saying that this little story about him rolling up bread kind of indicates for me his entire view of his entire life before he got the operation, that because he didn't have an overall understanding of what life is and what human interaction is, he couldn't then fit in the individual memories into that thing. And so he never thought about them, and just disappeared.
He also couldn't fit in expectations of other people.
No.
And this is also, like, his mother had expectations towards him.
But it's not just that he didn't understand them. It's just that he discarded them and didn't even think about them to the point where he forgot about it. They were still in his brain in the same way that the actions to pick something up and move it from one place to the other is in his brain. But when it was outside of his, like, I need to pick this up and put it over there, you know, when he didn't understand that kind of larger picture, the small steps, either the small steps physically or the small steps in his memory, just disappeared. It's a very I don't know, it's for me, I think that's one of those key scenes where, and that's at the part of the book where he's having a lot of these flashbacks, and I think that that's the part of the book where it slows down for me, where he's constantly, you know, seeing himself as a younger, and it's kind of explaining his predicament as a young child. But all of those little incidents have like a wider meaning of a wider story, and I think that one is one of the most important ones. Even though you think when I read it the first time, it didn't click in the same way that it clicked this time. You know,
of course,
that it's an explanation for his whole mindset and his view.
Yeah. Also, I think what we should talk about is his relationship with his family.
Yeah.
I noticed several differences there. So I mean, seeing it all through glasses of Freud psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
He had this mother, which was very, very, like, a very, like, big character in his life.
Yeah, controlling figure, yeah.
Very much.
Dominant
mother.
Yeah.
This is the perfect setup for psychoanalysis. Whatever. And,
psychoanalysis.
So his mother was threatening him, he was beating him, she was
Stab him at one point.
Yeah, she was very dominant, but still, till the end, like, he like, when he was a child, he didn't understand why she was even beating him.
No.
He didn't understand, all he was trying to do was making her love him.
Yeah.
And he always thought, oh, well, I have to try harder, I have to learn more, I have to do this and this and this, and then she will love me.
But that was his entire, that's the reason why he was picked, because he wanted to learn so much that he actually enrolled himself in a school.
Exactly. And then there was his father. What's the meaning of his father in his life?
Yeah.
Seeing backwards that he actually visited his father again.
Yeah.
And he didn't reveal himself.
No, I thought that's one of the most powerful scenes for me, when he sits down and says, oh, I'm meeting someone very important, very special, and I want to look my best. And his father gives him a haircut.
Yes.
To make him look his best, to meet his father. And I don't know, that's one of those scenes where I'm just like, no, just say who you are, because your father was the one who loved
you. Exactly.
His father loved him unconditionally all the way through, and yet He
never revealed himself to him. And that's the point. He went then to his his mother and his sister.
Well, it was quite a while later, wasn't it?
He was later, but he did go to them and he revealed himself.
Yeah.
Even though these two were the people who threatened him.
Yeah, but what's beautiful about it is that they both kind of have a change of heart, but they don't because his mother is senile by that point and the relationship is reversed.
Exactly.
The relationship is flipped around, yeah. Which again is one of those things where you go, oh, that's like, it's almost too cute. It's almost too clever in that way that now his mother was in the same situation as he was.
And he's in, like...
Yeah, the mother's situation. But then the sister comes home and that's one of those weird things where the sister was like, well, I was just a kid.
Yeah, exactly. That's also the point. There was this incident with the mattresses where they were jumping and stuff. Yeah. And then he explained his point of view and he explained what happened for him. And then she said, oh, well... Yeah, I never look at it like that.
Yeah.
My point of view was always that you were always in the
you were
point,
the special
you
one.
You were
yeah.
the special one. I had to do my homework. I had to do normal learning stuff. And this is exactly what's like when you look at how are children if they do something bad.
Yeah.
How are they punished or how are they treated in court? Because they have a totally different point of view. Very egoistic point of view.
Yeah.
And they can't look over to what is the other person experiencing in that same situation. The empathy is not it's not conscious
there. What is it that the model of mind, no, what is it, the I can't remember the technical term for a theory of mind, meaning that you think, but the theory of mind means that when you look at somebody else, you have to understand that the way they're thinking is the same way that you're thinking, or they have a thought process which is independent of your own, you know, and that's the reason, like, when you, you know, it's that test, when you look in the mirror, you understand that you're looking in a mirror, but, like, some animals don't do that because they don't even have a theory of mind about their own, you know, their own self.
Yeah.
And that's what Charlie is like at the beginning.
Yes.
You know, there is no Rorschach test, there is no, what's the other test where you tell stories about the people in the pictures and things. Like, he doesn't understand that that there is even anything going on in his mind to attribute to something that's going on in other people's minds.
Exactly.
And of course, as the book goes on, he then has a mistaken one when he's more intelligent. He's saying, these people were pretending to be intelligent. They said that they were the supermen of the human mind.
But he never said it.
Never did.
Bert even says that.
Bert says, they never said that. Or is it Strauss who said that?
It's Bert. Because that one point when he's more intelligent, he said, no, when I was not so intelligent, you said something different. You said it this way. And then they went back and they had recordings of it. And Bert said exactly the same thing. But it was Charlie.
It's a standardized test.
Just have a bit of paper and then you tick off boxes and stuff.
Yeah, you read the script.
You read it out. And then Charlie... I think at that point he's realizing that how much it is a personal point of view, what higher and lower means from your point of view, how you are.
Yeah.
And this book is so, it's just like...
You really enjoyed that psychoanalysis part.
It is really complex. And it's not only, it's this boy and he gets an operation.
Well, it is that. But the point is, if you want to read it as just, boy gets more intelligent, boy gets less intelligent, I think you would actually, people would enjoy the short story more because that is very much, you know, it's on that level.
Yeah.
This explores these many things. But apart from like the psychoanalysis point of view, where you're talking about the id and the ego and the superego and theory of mind and all that kind of stuff. What I also like is this great quote where they say, science is about proving what isn't so. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the note that I made here. And I really love that because this is a book about a failed scientific experiment written upon the point of view of the failed experimental subject.
Yeah.
And also from the point of view who disproved the science. And,
exactly.
I just read a thing on I can't remember which, by Phil Plait, about he's an astronomer, and he was talking about climate change denial and saying, you know, if climate change science was wrong, people would be publishing papers about it. And they said, you know, and he brought an analogy of the expanding universe. Everyone thought that after the Big Bang, the universe expands and then would start slowing down. And then they made some measurements and they're like, wait a second, it's not slowing down. It's speeding up. And they're like, everyone's like, no, it can't be speeding up. Everything, you can't, there can't be like an extra force which is speeding everything up. And then they're like, oh yeah, and then 10 years later they're like, ah, dark energy. And the idea being that there are these ways of viewing science which can overturn what's happened before, you know. It's proving what isn't so, and that's a way of like showing like our developing understanding. But so much science fiction is about proving what is so, like proving the new theory, coming up with new inventions. And I really like that this book is about a failure. It's about a scientific failure, and it's brought very close to home because it's like I say, it's a human failure.
Yes.
But I really like the idea that they're saying, even in the book, they're saying, look, these guys, they think he's pretending to be a great man, and everyone knows he's pretending to be a great man, and he's like, he knows he's pretending to be a great man, but for the sake of this, but for the sake of his place in the university and what his wife thinks, where everyone's going to allow him to pretend to be a great man like Einstein or like Freud or like, you know, these other people who had, like, you know, at the time, and even now, like with Einstein and Darwin and stuff like that, even now, still massively influential and important scientific discoveries. And, but I really like the fact that, no, it's about scientific failure, but that's just as important. Like, proving what doesn't work is, like, more
important.
They
even say that.
Yeah.
They even say that.
Yeah, I know.
Showing that something is wrong is, like, that something is going wrong.
Is as important as
something that is successful.
Yeah, but the point is that it comes down to, like, they present this thing and they do it too early and the science isn't worked out. But it's like a cautionary tale, not of what is bad about science, but actually the good methodology of science.
Yeah.
And I find it amazing to see here on Wikipedia, it's like themes. Or was it themes? I can't remember. But anyway, there was something here in the saying. It might not have been on the Wikipedia page, but it's saying, it's about the dangers of science. And I'm like, no, it's not about the dangers of science. It's about how science does work.
It's about science.
Yeah. And I don't think there's anything, I don't think there's any bad view of science. I think there's a lot of bad views about the treatment of mentally disabled people and disabled people and people who are less fortunate than you and poor people. And, you know, there's stuff about academia and the way that works and how people get professorships and where funding comes from. You know, there's a lot about there, but actually science itself, I don't think there's, you know, I don't think there's anything bad about science here. I think it's actually quite uplifting.
Yeah.
That even at the end of it, they're like, well, what's going to happen to you if this fails? Like, at the beginning, they're saying, this might fail. This might not be permanent. You may become more intelligent and then less intelligent. It may work. It might not work. It could be dangerous, but they get all the permissions correct. You know, theoretically, you know, they get that correct. They ask the parents, they ask him. Everyone's, it's kind of weirdly how it's all above board, and yet it's still a failure. But it's not a failure because anyone does anything wrong. It's not a failure because the scientific method doesn't work. It's not a failure because there's a bad guy in the story. Yeah. It's not a failure because aliens invade. It's not a failure because of all of the things that would normally happen to make something fail in science fiction, like someone plants a bomb, or there's this and does that. There's none of that kind of conflict. The conflict plays out like, they propose this theory, it works in animals, they test it on a human, and someone finds that it doesn't work, and they get the science together to prove it doesn't work, and they come up with a competing model which explains the data better than the previous model. Turns out that model is true, unfortunately for Charlie Gordon. But in the end, it's about...
But in the end, he is also very important, because he, like, by him being...
Yes, it's him, it's he, yeah, it, it's he who brings together all these different fields of knowledge,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly.
A bit from over here, a bit from over there, a bit from here.
And also, it's not very, this is what's also so impressive in that book. He is not only the person with bad luck in there. He is also taking part in it, because when he is then so intelligent that he can see the overall picture, he sees what's going on and he writes down all what is wrong with it.
One thing that I do find very interesting about the book is that it concentrates so much on the psychological, like, emotional development, you know, the things with his family and relationships, that in a way I kind of miss, like, the list of books that, I mean, he does list, I read this book and I read that book and I read this book and I've been learning this language and this language and this language and I've done this expert thing and I talked to this person. Like, in a way, I kind of want more of that. You know, like he comes up with this invention, there's this scanner thing, and he sends a message to the person who built the scanner and said, oh, you got this mistake. You made this mistake and this mistake and this mistake in this in your previous report. And he goes, yeah. Oh, and he keeps him on the phone for an hour and a half to talk with him. In a way, I kind of wish there was more of that, but that's not going to be in his personal journal. That's not going to be in his progress reports. That's going to be in... He talks about all this other research that he's doing, and I kind of want to see that research.
Of course.
But that's not what this book is about. You know, it feels a bit unbalanced in that way. Like, I kind of wanted a bit more of that.
Because you're a nerd.
Maybe a few fewer flashbacks to his childhood and a bit more science.
But again, these flashbacks are important.
Yeah.
And they also show, again, in a Freud kind of view, this is what they do in psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
They work with this free association, which was this storytelling, and they work with dream
analysis
and all this stuff. Yeah. And these flashbacks are just something that comes out.
Of course.
And is also...
I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying that, like, on balance in this book... But in a way, I'm glad for that because it is a very, very dated book in some ways because of all the Freudian analysis and the treatment of, you know, mentally disabled people and the care homes that they put them in. You know, all these care homes that, they closed down all the asylums. Well, not all of the asylums, but many of the asylums in America closed down. And now these people are, you know, generally homeless people or being cared for, in homes and things.
Or by their families.
Yeah, by the family, being cared for by the families. You know, that whole system doesn't... I mean, it says that they go to the Warren School for boys or whatever it is. I can't even remember what it... But there's like thousands of people out there. And that's just for New York City.
And even what... Like when he was having a tour through that, the guy, the director, what he was, he even said, we have a waiting list of 14,000 people or something. Or even 40,000 people.
No, I think it was a few hundred people.
No, it was a huge amount of people waiting to get... A place in a home where they are like put into.
I'd have to search for that again in the book to check that.
But anyway.
No, my point is that it's dated in some ways in that way. Yes. But I think that if they'd have included, if Daniel Keyes had included more of these scientific things, it would have dated even more. You know, I can kind of read this, it works really well as a modern story or as a universal story because it doesn't use lots of technology. I mean, there is the main. Like brain process that happens at the beginning,
and but like, goes clear into
it. It doesn't go into it. So even now, you could rewrite a lot of this and include, like, instead of him going to the library and reading books, he just goes through like Wikipedia and he's got like a pub.med, no, was it whatever the publication websites are, scientific publication website, instead of actually reading the physical journals. But this story would work, or like the overall story would work just as well. Even in the modern day, I think.
Yeah, everybody understands what it means that he goes to the library and just reads and reads and reads.
But, he talks on telephones and he gets an apartment here and stuff like that. It is dated, but like I'm saying, I'm glad that there isn't more science fiction or there is more science-y bits in it.
Yeah.
Because those would date worse.
Yeah.
Even worse in a way.
So there's one more thing I wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. Some few more, but like... One was that sometimes I wouldn't say that I feel too intelligent or something.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think like if I would just be a little bit more
You want to be less intelligent sometimes.
Yes, because being as self-aware as I am, I think a lot.
Yes.
And sometimes I wish I would just think less.
And then you could get some better sleep.
And then
at night.
I could just have more friends because I don't realize that they're not my friends. But I feel that they are my friends.
So you want to be more like Charlie at the beginning of the book where you just presume everyone's really
sometimes
friendly.
Sometimes that is very easy, isn't it?
I don't know, I guess.
V's life is like he has friends and he has a family.
Yeah,
And this is what it's about, and he's happy. He is a happy guy at the beginning.
Yes, he was very happy. They even say that in the book, like, now you became more intelligent, but you lost your good nature.
Yeah, you lost your good nature.
So what you want everyone to live in a happy idiocracy where everyone is a bit stupid but happy.
Yeah, why not?
But that's one of those long arguments in science fiction that it has with itself. It's like, do we keep people dumb and happy, or do we let them have intelligence and unhappiness?
This is the whole thing about I think so, I am.
Yeah, I think therefore. But that is always the dichotomy. Stupid people can be happier, and intelligent people. I'm not saying this is true. I don't believe it to be true. But I'm just saying that's what science. That's the conversation that science fiction has with itself. You know, and. Yeah. Personally, I don't see it that way. I would rather everyone be not like, instead of me going, oh, I wish I was less intelligent or less self-aware and then I'd be happier, I wish everyone could be more intelligent. I'm not going to say more intelligent like me, but again, it's one of those utopian ideals, like, why can't everyone be like me?
But doesn't everybody say that? I say that too.
Of course. Like, if everyone was just at my level of intelligence, that means I wouldn't have to explain stuff to people. If everyone was at my level of intelligence, but then again, there's people more intelligent than I am, and I want them to be less intelligent, back down to my level of intelligence. Like, why are you always talking about that? Why doesn't everyone just come down to my level, you know?
Yeah.
Why can't people...
Your level is the perfect level.
Yeah, my level is the perfect level for me.
Exactly. What is the perfect level? And sometimes I think, in some situations...
You want to be a bit lower down.
Yeah. Because then, like, yeah, I mean, this is what always happens.
Go on, give me a good example, a specific example.
Okay, in singing...
Yes.
It is... so much about letting go.
You're talking as a professional singer.
I'm talking about as a professional singer in classical music. And so often, especially with practicing, if you would think less, this is always the point, think less and let your body just do it, it would work better. But because, like, this is also what I experience with students that come to me and are adults. It is always the first thing you have to do is you have to get people away from thinking and rating themselves. So they sing some notes and then they say, oh no, that wasn't good.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't do it right.
Oh, you mean they're too intellectually self-critical.
Exactly. And this always holds you back from just saying, oh yeah, that was good, I can do better. And just, you know, this whole mindset that we are always way too critical and we think
This is what makes people rock and roll stars. You know, like when you see someone like Mick Jagger on stage, famous for dancing like a crazy man.
Yeah.
It's because he is at that point. Obviously a super intelligent guy, very talented and things, but and all that. But to become a rock star, you need to turn off that self-critical to be able to do a bit. Like, this is one of the things that I had to, like, train myself as a musician to be able to turn off the thing which stopped me worrying about going, yeah, like that at the end, you know, and actually to do that. And I find that freedom to play around with music comes when I'm actually performing for the first time.
Yes.
And so much of what I do comes from performing the song in front of an audience for the first time, because I think I know what I'm going to do until I'm in front of an audience.
And you then don't suddenly, think anymore.
And then I don't think anymore.
Exactly.
And that's where all of the quirks come and the funny looks to the audience and the smiles and the whoops and the little comments that I put in and the pauses that, you know, pauses for laughter if it's a comedy song and things. Yeah, but there's no way for me to do that until I'm on stage and I'm just concentrating on getting through to the end of the song. Well, not even concentrating on that. I just got to go.
You don't concentrate at all. You just do it. And this is the point.
But
this is your unconscious taking over.
Yeah.
It's
like a Jackson Pollock painting.
Yeah.
And
this is what I mean when I say I want to be less intelligent, because, like, in practice, if you could put this quirky, I just do it. And this is also, I think, very specifically a problem of classical musicians, because you brought up, you have this sheet music and this is your frame and this is what you have to do.
You can only do it within those instructions.
You have these instructions, and then also you have this certain, like in classical music, this is the right way of singing.
Mm-hmm.
This is how you do singing, and you have to fit in that frame. The first time I experienced that music is actually something you can create is when I had to do improvisation courses in university.
Yeah.
And then I saw, oh wow, music is something that I can do. I can create that.
You're saying this as someone who's studying classical singing at university.
Exactly. And then you think, oh well, you as a classical musician, you have this frame, and then you're always thinking, I have to fit in this frame, I have to be perfect to represent the music, because the music is perfect and I have to be perfect to do that. And all this thinking takes place all the time. And sometimes I wish I could just turn it off and just, oh, well, I just do what I do.
Yeah.
And because I am so aware...
You want to free associate with your singing in a way, yeah.
Yeah.
That is a good example, but I do think that, like, the overall wish, it's like, it is that you want freedom from self-analysis, or freedom from self-criticism, in a way. And I, you know, you see drunk people, and they're just happy. Like, those people that we saw on the street last night, shouting and shouting at people going past. And you think, oh, wouldn't it be great to not be a dick, but have that same self-freedom, you know? And you understand, you go, oh, that's why people take drugs. It's because they want to...
They want to lose their self...
Yeah, their
control, self-awareness, like, I just... There's sometimes that, you know, it's a weird thing. I think many people have that. In an opera, when you go, in your theatre, in a concert, everybody sits still on their seats.
Yeah.
I sometimes have the wish I could just stand up and just jump over the seats.
Yeah.
Do you have that?
Of course, like every time I'm sitting anywhere.
Why do you have that? Why do you never do it?
Well, it does happen sometimes, not with me so much, but, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But sometimes I wish I would have just the freedom to just say, oh, I would be happy doing that now, and then do it. And then just realizing, okay, because I know...
Now I'm getting kicked out.
Exactly. Because I know the consequences will be. The consequences will not be, oh, I'm jumping over the seats
and
everybody happy and everybody's happy. No, there will be a consequence. Mm-hmm. I will be kicked out and I will have maybe...
Psychoanalysis.
Exactly.
But this is the difference between movie worlds, like in the movies, when somebody does something at the end of the movie and it's really important and it's like illogical, but they go with their heart or they go with the feelings, they do something crazy, and then everyone starts with the slow hand clap.
Yeah.
Like this, and then everyone joins in and it becomes this huge round of applause and everything, woo, like this, because they just believed, they just did the thing. I can't think of any movie off the top of my head, but you've seen it at the end of so many movies.
Yeah.
In the real world, people, first of all, everyone will just ignore that person. You know, they're literally just immediately ignorable, because sure, they did a wedding proposal at the end, but, you know, wedding proposals go on like all the time everywhere. Yeah. And they're not special, sorry, but, you know, wedding proposals, just like, for everyone who's ever got married, there's been a wedding proposal. It's like when it happens at the end of the movie and everyone claps, that's not really what happens, unless it's in a, like, an artificial situation, you know, where they have a big movie screen, or, you know, it's in the middle of an ice rink or something, and they go down and one, you know, that kind of thing, people will clap. But I heard this thing that in this ice rink at the Rockefeller Center in New York, while somebody was waiting there for an hour, there was three proposals, and everybody thought that their proposal was the special one. But if you've been waiting there an hour, they just came along, because it's, you know, by the Christmas tree in the Rockefeller Center. It's just that romantic place.
This is again the personal point of view for everybody else.
It's really special.
It is the very special point, and then you see from the outside.
The cynical outside. Special. But this is my point, that at the end of the movies, that's what happens. And in reality, nobody cares. Or if you do something really crazy, you get locked up as a crazy person.
Or you do a dance thing on YouTube, everybody loves you for it.
Yeah, no, 99.9999999% of all people who have ever done a crazy dance and uploaded it to YouTube, nobody cares. It's only the 0.00001% of funny videos that get uploaded on YouTube that anybody actually cares about, you know. And they only care about it for about 15 seconds as the video happens.
Yeah.
And then moves on.
That's true.
And it's the very unique people who can make it.
There's one more point I want to talk about.
Oh, there's two more points. One more point for me as well.
We had the masturbation thing in the last... So we should go back to sexual things. And Freud, sexual is something very big.
Yeah, of course.
It's all the... How you call it in English? The drives and stuff. And here I read on the Flowers for Algernon Wikipedia page that there's a censorship.
Yeah.
I didn't even consider that there's any, like...
Yeah, because he has sex with Faye and has weird non-sex with Alice.
Yes, but...
And shits himself and things when he has sex.
Yeah, but what?
No, maybe I'm mixing up the situation.
And no, what I think, what they think is worth to do giving censors on is when, you know, his mother, what always is her concern is that Charlie is abusing Norma. This is always, don't touch her, don't touch her. You're thinking
oh, yeah,
bad
at one
things,
point he has an erection, and the father's like, oh, the erection, they just can't, you know, no kid can undo it. It's like, I'll beat that erection out of him. It's like, yeah, you've never,
holy shit,
you've never known a kid, a male.
And it doesn't matter how,
8-year-old boy,
what his psychological condition is. And, But in Freud, sexuality is the big thing.
Yeah.
Everything is put back problems in your childhood and the sexual depression or suppression in your childhood that every male wants to have sex with the mother. I don't think it's true.
No, but it's an interesting analysis.
It's an interesting analysis, and it is part of this book, definitely. And there is this there's this one dream sequence or whatever he's experienced there when he has this whole like it's you can read it as like near death thing.
Yeah.
But I read it different. For me, this is the total point. This is his birth, and. You know that
he's remembering. He's at the height of his intelligence. He can remember everything so much that he's going back to his birth.
And there is this.
Yeah, that's a good reading of that.
There was this guy. Sorry, it's my phone. Ignore it. There was this guy. His name was.
You've lost it.
Oh shit! Where is it?
Go on. Find the right Wikipedia page. The German Wikipedia page about the guy.
It's Otto.
Well, just do a search. Just do command F, and then type in Otto. Page.
Let me do it. Trauma.
The birth trauma.
Yeah, Otto Rank.
Yeah.
Was a psychoanalyst.
Yeah.
And he wrote a book about the trauma of the birth.
Yeah, and you think that's what we're finding here in Flowers for Algernon?
Yes, but also this Otto Rank writing this book, it was then later on that Freud said no, the psychological. The being starts with the birth. Yeah. There is no prenatal psychology.
Yeah.
But I think in that book, in that middle bit where he's like sees the light and then he feels the pain and then he goes towards it.
Because as he goes along, he has better and better recall. He's actually saying, now I'm at the point where I don't even know if the thing I'm remembering is real, is happening now, if I'm remembering it from the past. Like, what is happening now, and what are just memories that are coming back from the past?
Yes.
And, yeah, so that does make a big, that does make a lot of sense, where he's got to the point where he can even remember his birth.
Yeah.
It's still in his brain somewhere, and now he's got the mental powers to dig it out.
And after he had this, he came, like, this was on the down bit.
Yeah.
Where then he had this reveal that, I can go and love Alice and stuff.
Yeah.
So this is like, in all this psychoanalysis, once you step over these traumas...
Yeah. You're past
kind of healed.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got to get past the past traumas.
Yeah, exactly. And so it based all on childhood traumas in psychoanalysis and in sexual trauma as well.
Yeah.
And I think actually he has some quite big sexual traumas,
but
especially through his mother.
Yeah.
Because she's dominant and because she's suppressing his sexual. Yeah, I mean...
Desires, yeah, sexual development.
Exactly. So,
but he's never had to worry about it up until now.
No, of course not.
Yeah. Anyway, anything else to do? Because I've got one last topic about a movie adaptation.
Okay, yeah, I wrote that down.
Yeah, Juliana this morning asked me, hey, do you want to watch the movie of this book before we discuss it? First of all, there's different movies. Here we go. 1961 television drama. 1968 film. Called Charlie. Oh, the first one is Two Worlds of Charlie Gordon. Next one is Charlie. A stage play from 1969. A musical from 1978. There's a 91 radio play. Another television movie from 2000. A Japanese drama from 2002. French television movie from 2006. And then a modern dance work from 2006. Plus further stage and radio adaptations have been introduced in 1984, 1988, 1982. You know, so this is a very well adapted book, you know, anytime that you get a book which gets like three or four different movie versions of it, it's very well. So in the end, you're like going, it's like us watching Solaris and Solaris, you know, like which one of these movie adaptations do you want me to watch? The original one? Or the one that won Cliff Robertson an Academy Award for Best Actor? You know, is that the one that you're talking about? And I just actually looked at this at Charlie, the movie, and it actually says, I was just reading through, and they say they use like picture-in-picture and split screens to show simultaneous reactions of two people facing each other and conversing. So they'll show, like, two people, you know, and they're... you can see it from both points of view.
Yeah, at the same time.
And then they have these little, you know, like these little postage stamps inserts of images within the larger screen frame. So it seems quite an experimental movie. I've not seen it, but it seems quite experimental that they're actually inserting in different reaction shots or little memories like that play alongside. Like if something's happening, they'll play a little memory of Charlie from when he was younger playing alongside it. And I think the reason why I don't want to watch the movie is because in my head, certainly when I was reading through this time, I was thinking, well, what would a good movie adaptation of this book be? Yeah. And for me, it would be something a bit like a Spike Jonze kind of movie. You know, have you seen Adaptation, the movie where... Nicolas Cage plays himself twice and he's adapting a book and he's playing himself and his in this it, but it's one of those things
called adaptation.
I think in German it's called adaptation. It's a movie, but also like we watch Being John Malkovich, you know, it's one of those psychological things where people can meet themselves and things like that. It's called adaption and in German, and adaptation which one's the German title? Anyway, I can't see. What my movie version of this would be, it would start off with just one actor playing Charlie as he's 30 years old. And then it gets up to the point where when he becomes, and also you'll film all the scenes twice, one from the reality point of view and one from Charlie's point of view. So we'll see the scenes of him in the bakery at the beginning, but everything's nice and everyone's smiling and everyone is actually really good natured.
Yeah.
And
they're laughing.
And they're laughing and stuff like that. Then later on, when he starts reviewing his childhood and reviewing his past experience, what you'd also do then is have the same scenes filmed again from the same point of view, but then have two Charlies in each scene. You would have Charlie as he looked previously, but also kind of standing over his shoulder or kind of lingering in the background or standing on the side of the room.
Watching through the window.
And you'd actually see him now, like, dressed smarter with a proper shave or whatever he looks like in the more advanced version of him. Yeah. And then whenever he goes back and then Charlie is there, so in the sex scenes, you know, when he's trying to have sex with people and at one point, you know, where he disappears and gets drunk, where he doesn't disappear, but old Charlie comes out again.
Yeah.
You'd actually switch back to the other, not the other actor, but like the other makeup and actually make it that the movie itself is unreliable and from his point of view.
Yeah.
And then at some points he switches around and is like, oh, and I needed to go there. And then I saw myself from outside when he was getting drunk and actually just switch those actors around. So for the entire second half of the movie, in any one scene, there's actually the actor twice.
Yeah.
There's him being the arrogant new guy, but also over his shoulder, just in the background, is Charlie, and he just follows him around. Nobody else interacts with the other one who isn't meant to be interacting.
Yeah, but
then at some points they'll switch around, and I think it would be really amazing in the sex scene, you know, in the sex scenes where he's trying to control himself, and then Charlie takes over and starts crying and stuff. Whereas he is, his current state, which is then brought out, and I think that would be the real fun experimental one. And also when you see him as a child, you could actually just have his current where he is, and you have a child actor doing it, but he's in the room with the same person.
And
I think that would be a fascinating way. And then at the end, of course, you just go back to Charlie and the other guy disappears.
Yes.
And so having
it's slowly like fading out or something.
Well, not so much fading out, but just not being there anymore. And it would be one of those things that when it's suddenly, when there's not two Charlies in the scene anymore, you're just like, oh, where's the other Charlie? Oh, where's the other Charlie? Yeah. You know, and at one point, like when he goes to see Alice at the end and he sits down in his seat, you know, in the school. Talking about Kenyon, he sits there and he's there, blah, 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 blah. And then when he suddenly realizes what he's doing, suddenly the other Charlie is back, you know, the more intelligent Charlie is back, kind of taps him on the shoulder and takes him out of the classroom again. And then as it goes on, the other Charlie kind of disappears and it's just the one Charlie. In my mind, that would be the way to tell this story, is to have one actor playing multiple parts at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, playing advanced Charlie.
This is how the book works.
Well, yeah, and I was just thinking that, like, in my head, that is now the movie version. When I'm picturing it, that's what I want. So I don't want to watch this other movie version. Yeah. Well, maybe I do want to, because I mean, it seems like they're doing it.
I actually do want to watch it.
But it seems like you say they are doing this experimental stuff about, you know, about this picture-in-picture stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Almost every sequence is done in split screens, multiple images, still shots or slow motion, you know.
Yeah.
It does feel quite experimental and Oscar-worthy in some ways.
Yeah, somebody else on Goodreads, I think it was Tamahome Road. Good film or something.
Oh, is it a good film?
He wrote here, good movie too.
Okay.
The question is which one, but
who
I guess...
did that? Guillermo?
No, Tamahome.
Oh, no. Tamahome. Ah, I didn't see that comment.
Yeah, he commented on my review.
Ah, okay. So maybe we should... Oh, that's why you asked me this morning if you want to watch the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we could watch the movie, but just for the sake of this review, I think it's good. I'll probably read this book in another 5 years or so and
also,
check it out.
Also, I just wanted to mention that at the end, the most touching scene for me was, first of all, when he went back to the bakery.
Yeah.
And the guys who, beforehand, Charlie thought they were laughing with him when he did funny stuff. And then later, when it was in the middle of the book, he started realizing that they were laughing at him.
Yeah.
And not treating him very, very kind.
Yeah.
But at the end, when he came back there after being very intelligent, how these people treated him.
Yeah, it's a very forgiving book. It's a very hopeful book.
It's so heartbreaking that they said, well, that's Charlie, and let's get rid of that person. He's not treating him well.
Yeah.
And then they really, in the end, it turns out they really are his friends.
Yeah.
And this is so touching. And yeah, that was the point where I thought, where I really had this stone in my belly. It was like, oh.
Yeah, for me, it's when he goes into the classroom and he sits down and Alec looks at Ms. Kinnean.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm just like, no, he doesn't really. Oh, no. And he's just like, oh, well, I'm going to go off to the Warren Boys School, boys or whatever it is, or retard school or whatever they call it in this book, which is weird. Yeah, just put some flowers on Alton's grave every day. And it's just,
and I cried.
Yes, I had tears in my eyes. Not so much as I did the first time I read through the first novel, but that was I talked about that in my other review when some music came on, and it was the song was "Fix You" by Coldplay. And it was at the end of this book, and I said, "Oh, I'll make you a playlist to listen to at the end of this book." Of course, I didn't get around to it. But anyway, listen to that for a full lyric reading of what was going through my brain at the same time. So. Yes. Anything else to add? Because we've gone on. Whenever there's two people on this podcast, whenever there's two of us, we always talk like over an hour. But I think it's worth it for these books. So let's do this. A rating. No, you can't play that because then I have to pay license fees and stuff.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't. So. Yeah. Can people? Nobody will be able to hear it anyway. Just. Put it. So you've got to do a rating for this book. What are you going to give it?
5 stars.
You're going to give it 5 stars.
Definitely. Yes.
Okay. Well, I didn't enjoy this quite as much as I did before, mainly because there's a few things, a few little pieces where I think it's a bit heavy-handed in some points, and of course on the second read through, because I know exactly what's going to happen. You know.
Obviously.
I mean, the thing is, I knew the story before because I read the short story version, and it does have quite a few big differences. But in this version, it wasn't that I just knew the story. I knew what was going to be, you know, what language playing things he was going to do. And at the beginning, it was like, oh, these people are really my friends and stuff like that. I did think it was a little bit more heavy-handed, and I didn't have the same reaction. But of course, it's a second read-through. But then other books I read through the second time, and I enjoy them more.
Yeah.
You know, like we did with The Prefect.
I think with this book, it is really difficult to have the same experience when you read it twice.
Yeah. But you already knew what happened at the end, didn't you? You knew the basic story, that he got intelligent and then became less intelligent at the end. It's no surprise.
It wasn't a big surprise, but it was the way it took place. And the way it happened. And that all was very... It is so well written. Just imagine, this is one person writing this whole thing.
Yeah, but he spent like 5 years on it.
It's amazing. And like how he can just like feel himself into these two separate...
Into this right mindset.
Yeah.
It always makes me wonder, it's like, when he was writing this, did he... Of course, he had different versions as he went through it. But did he write it, like, all the way through, just in normal English, and then go through and change it? Or did he start, you know... Or did he write it in one go? Or did he write the beginning and the end, and then the next bit and the next bit? You know, like how did he do...
No, I think because he had these experiences with students with, they call it here, with special needs.
Yeah.
I think he and obviously that Keyes is a very empathic kind of person. He can transfer himself in how do these people see the world.
Yeah. That's the amazing, that's my favorite writing at the beginning, but also in the middle of the book it's more subtle when he becomes more intelligent.
Yeah.
But it's just, for me, it's just as powerful, like how wrong Charlie is, like how Charlie is misunderstanding the world at that point. Yeah. As well.
Yes.
Anyway, because I rate these books purely on enjoyment, like subjective enjoyment of my reading experience, and I know it goes up and down as I read these things, you know, read books from one to the other.
You also were reading it on the trip we were on.
No, but it's only taken about 4 hours, you know. But it was just a different reading experience, different soundtrack, different expectations. So I'm going to give it 4.5 stars.
Okay.
So in total, this book can have 4.75 stars. Not because it's a bad book, and I do highly recommend it, but just for myself, I have to, if I'm rating my individual subjective experience of a book.
Oh, this is actually quite interesting.
Yeah, it's like a 4-star book overall.
Yeah.
And
but most of my friends, and I think of your friends too, because my friends are mostly your friends too, they rated it 5 stars.
Oh no, there's quite many a few. No, look here, on a science fiction book, like Guillermo, 3 stars, Emmanuel, 4 stars. There's quite a few. There's quite a few 3-star reviews.
Lot of 5 stars.
Yeah, a lot
of
5 stars. So it is a very good book. SFBRP listeners on Goodreads.com, which are my friends on Goodreads.com, give it a 4.17 average, and in total a 3.95 average. But like I say, even if you're not interested in, even if you don't think it's going to be the best book you've ever read, like lots of people think it's their favorite science fiction book, it's still a classic, it's still influential, it's still very much worth reading. Even if you disagree with all the Freudian analysis, and if you don't believe what Freud had to say, it actually matches up with the real world, which I don't, and which you don't either. But it's interesting. It's an interesting rule set to mess around within. And that's what I love about science fiction, is that you set rules, and then you play out those rules and see how those rules interact with human emotion and learning and society and things. And that's what this book does perfectly.
Yes, it does.
Even if it doesn't do it scientifically accurately, it does what it does perfectly, I think.
Yeah.
So, let's give it 4.75
that's
out of
good.
5. Yeah, it's a good average rating between the two of us. So that's it. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. You become my friend on Goodreads and become an SFBRP listener group member on there, and you can discuss this and discuss things with other people, start some new discussions. That'll be great there. Or you can become Juliana's friend on Goodreads. You can find her by looking for Juliana. You'll be able to find her.
Or just looking on Luke's friend list.
Yeah, but you're one of many friends for me.
Okay.
So you're not, I don't think there's a way of saying who's a top friend on Goodreads. Unfortunately,
all
I leave everyone
top
a top friend. So you, as my girlfriend, can't be a top friend.
I'm a top.
There are no friends in that way. But that's great as well. You can check out Audible, audibletrial.com/SFBIP to help support the podcast, which will be really cool. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurridge on Twitter too. Which I don't post a lot there, but which is good, because that means you can follow me and I won't overwhelm you with tweets about everything, just about some little bits and pieces. So that's about it. Anything else to add? No?
No.
Next book. What's the next book we're going to read together? I guess we're going to move on with the culture series.
Inversions.
Let's do it.
Is it?
I guess that'll be the next book review we do together, and there's some other books
maybe
that I'll get to.
If we not find something else.
Just random.
In the meantime.
But no, you had this from the library, so you had to read it now because you have to take the book back.
Exactly.
To the library.
Yeah, yeah. I had Flowers from Elsewhere.
Oh, how was the German translation? You said that the spelling mistakes in the German version at the beginning were more than the English version.
I started reading the beginning and I was thinking, what's going on here? I didn't quite get it right from the start. I was thinking, what's going on? And then I read the first page of the English book and there's less, like, it's different kind of spelling mistakes. And in German, pretty much every word is wrong somehow.
No, because a lot of the spelling is correct. It's a lot of the grammar is bad.
In English?
In both, I'm saying.
No, in German, the grammar is okay. I mean, he's writing normal sentences. But way more words are spelled wrongly than in the English one. And also you have, this is also a bit more the what people would say it's difficult in German. You have the big letter, you're way more words with
capital letters. And, all the nouns. And,
yeah. So it was a bit, it felt a bit too over the top.
Overwhelming. But you soon get into it.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Well, that's good. I think that's everything I have to say. So thanks a lot for listening. Say goodbye, Juliana.
Goodbye, Juliana.
And we'll catch you next time.